So let's look at what the future looks like and what the farm is like with the conversation that we're going to have now. We know that agriculture is heading in new and different directions. We know that farmers are more CEOs than they have been before. We know that technology is coming in has arrived in remarkable ways. And farmers are also engaged in their own public relations effort, whether it's in the community or in the larger conversation. So let me introduce our panel. Let me start with Bruce the Onion Man Fraser. I feel like I'm sort of ringside here. Ladies and gentlemen, Bruce the Onion Man Fraser. Somebody said we have somebody from Mississippi and Texas and we need 2 hours. That's not going to happen. But Bruce is president of Dixondale Farms, located in Carrizo Springs, Texas. The 100th anniversary you're celebrating now. Not you, but the farm, right? Producing approximately 70% of the onion plants grown in the United States, and the largest cantaloupe grower in Texas. I'm not sure how cantaloupe and onions happen side by side.
One follows the other.
Okay. Clearly, I'm not a farmer. So, Bruce holds a bachelor's degree in civil engineering from the U.S. Military Academy, and he's a retired Army lieutenant colonel. So we say thank you for your service in both dimensions.
Thank you.
Next, Jeremy Jack. Jeremy is a partner with Silent Shade Planting Company in Belzoni, Maryland. He was recognized, and I first met Jeremy, last year with the 2013 Bayer Crop Sciences Young Sustainable Farmer Award. He and his sister were also the 2013 honorees in America's Best Young Farmer and Ranchers program. He serves on numerous industry boards and committees. And this is the Mississippi part. Mississippi State University graduate worked under Senator Thad Cochran in Washington. Don't hold that against him. During the 2008 Farm Bill as part of his graduate work at MSU. And what was it you said about Mississippi and Texas, right?
We're going to be here for a while. I hope you're ready.
And rounding out our panel is third-generation farmer from Eureka, Illinois, Chad Lehman. Chad is co-owner of Lehman Farms, Inc., and third generation of his family to lead the farm. Several thousand acres of corn and soybeans and more than 9,000 hogs. Yesterday he was telling me that bacon is a health food. So I feel much better now. You're in six counties, is that right? Six counties. Serves as president of Rock Creek LLC, board member Eagle Point LLC, both farms representing over 9,000 sows, and has served on the school board since 2007 there?
Yeah,
is that right?
That's correct.
So,
yep.
Welcome to all of you. Let's talk a little bit about farmers as CEOs. You consider yourself a CEO?
No. I think the term makes me think that, you know, if I told somebody I was CEO, that means I'm higher up or too good to do the things that I do. I consider myself the president, maybe the president.
How about the boss?
The boss, the patron.
How has your operation, well, tell folks a little bit about your operation, what you're doing.
Well, the onion transplant business, we split it up in about four different marketing areas. About 25% of our sales go to farmers, 25% go to the big box stores, 25% go to independent garden centers, and 25% go to the mail order. Our mail order business, I think we ship somewhere around 200,000 packages to individuals planting onions in their gardens and truck farmers. So
200,000?
Yeah.
And how's that comes to you all online, or how's that?
Some online, fax. We still have people on the phone. We have a call center that.
You mean I can call and talk to a real human being?
You can call and talk to a person that knows about it. So, you know, in that regard, we've changed based on survival. You know,
How have you changed?
Well, we took a different area of marketing to where we wanted to do more on the retail. You know, we're price givers. A lot of people in the farming industry are price takers. So we wanted to be a price giver. We wanted to be get more. The demand was there. The distribution system was breaking down.
So when and how did you decide to change your sort of business model?
Well, it was back in 1990 when fuel prices went up. We used to send a truckload of onion plants into Pittsburgh, and peddlers would pick them up and deliver them to all these little garden centers or pick them up at that. And then they wanted a half a truckload 2 days a week. Now they want a fourth of a truck. They don't want to inventory anything. So it was much more difficult to get the product there just at the time. So we said, well, wait a minute. We'll just cut those people out and we'll just be a direct to consumer.
And what's been the impact on the bottom line?
Well, probably generated five times the amount of sales that we did before.
Now, is this a model that others in agriculture can replicate?
Yeah, if you find your niche and
he couldn't do this with sows, I don't think.
We talked about a friend of his growing ornamental pumpkins and things like that. You know, I have a friend in doing that, and wedding planners are just knocking them down trying to find things. So, I mean, you know, think about the things that you do, what you do, or just social media. Just get out there, do videos. Everyone can buy one of those little...
You do that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I can see you on a camera. You know, this would work. Jeremy, tell us about your operation.
We have a cotton, corn, soybeans, rice, and wheat farm in the Mississippi Delta. We're about 97-98% irrigated, and our big push is conservation and sustainability, to the fact of not only doing what we're doing, but taking what we're doing and showing and telling everybody.
Showing and telling.
Having scientifically defensible data to prove what we're saying. So we can say something, but hey, we also have proof of this also.
So walk us into the sustainability thing you're talking about. What does that mean? What are you doing? What counts as sustainability in your operation?
Well, it's not a one system. It's a full system approach. It's just not one little piece. It's everything that you do. And one part of that is our irrigation. So we've got a 800-acre farm that will be, in another 2 years, we'll have it completely closed off to where water never leaves the farm. It goes from the fields to the ditches into a reservoir and then reused for irrigation again, which we get 56 inches of rain a year. There's a lot of water being turned over in our area. But we're testing the water as it comes off the field, testing it as it comes back out of the reservoir to see, is there nutrients in the water that's coming off the field? If there is, are we putting nutrient-rich water back onto the fields to reuse that fertilizer?
So there's water. So water is a big part of this. What else when you talk sustainability?
Water, when you look at the equipment that we have and how the technology that we use with the equipment that we have today, we can cover more ground with less equipment, less people using less diesel fuel, less inputs, and we can do this with the technology and the products that are out there and have higher yields, so we can feed more people by using less inputs.
How much less input?
It's dependent on so many different crops and so many different factors, but we've seen even it's little things as even taking fields and seeing which way the tractors turn around, which way does the tractor turn around to be more efficient. We looked at our sprayer last year, and we were idling our sprayer half the time of the year. It sat idling and to be filled up. Well, then we need to look at how we can fill our sprayer up quicker. So it's just even little things.
Are you doing that?
Mm-hmm.
So how much less idle time is there?
We figured we'll be able to cut it down 75% by the changes that we have.
75%? What are you doing?
We just put a larger pump, and we had a larger pump that was already on the farm. We're using it for other things at different times of the year, so it was actually sitting that time of year. But the technology was able to, the sprayer actually told us how much time we were idling and how much time we were working, and half the hours we used were idling. So by having that technology available, we never thought we were idling that much. But that's wasting fuel and wasting time and resources, and now we're much more efficient by just changing our operation.
You consider yourself a CEO?
I do.
You call yourself a CEO or the boss or whatever?
I do, but I'm kind of the same thing. I'm, you know, a general and a soldier at the same time. You know, I lead, but there's...
How big is your operation? How many people work for it?
We, between the farm and the trucking, we have around 30 employees. So every day, it doesn't matter what it is. If there's a truck that's broke down on the side of the road, I'll stop and jump, get underneath the truck and fix it. There's nothing on my farm that I can't do, and there's nothing on my farm I don't know how to do. But we've realized I can't do everything, and therefore we put structure in place to achieve more, and by having the structure in place, we're able to see these inefficiencies and pick up to make ourselves more sustainable.
Now, I understand there's a little nepotism at work here. You've hired your wife in a... What's she doing?
She's my wife is in charge of human resources, public relations, and any other wild projects I come up with that I get in trouble for.
Wife is in charge of public relations. That could be really dicey stuff. So this is the show and tell part? I mean, I'm interested in that. So what are you showing and telling?
What we're wanting to do with this that Swan Farm was that it'll be a demonstration farm. We'll have two or three demonstration days a year. We're wanting to actually set up for where school kids can follow through social media and a blog and webcams and follow what we're doing every day on that farm as a training project. So someone in, you know, in California can watch how a rice farm in Mississippi Delta actually does work and sees how it works with their own eyes.
Why are you doing this?
Someone needs to. And that's the thing is, if you go out there and it really just bothers me, just do hashtag agriculture and you'll look and see different pictures of what's not true, different e-cards that really scare you. And I feel like agriculture is turning around, or farmers are turning around and figuring out we have to be more vocal of what we're actually doing, because if we don't tell the story, somebody else will. So we just have to control the story and use it. But we have to have the truth and the facts to follow it up, because we're not doing any good if we're just going out there saying certain things.
Truth and fact. I was having a conversation with somebody yesterday about who provides the truth and the facts with all the noise out there. And so that's great to hear.
And the data and the equipment that we have collects all the data for us. We just have to analyze it and prove it to them.
Well, I want to come back with all of you after talking to Chad a little bit and hear more about what you're showing and telling and how much you're sharing and what the data is and that you're doing and all. But Chad, tell us what you're up to these days.
We're a typical Midwest row crop farm, so corn and soybeans, and we market about 60,000 pigs a year. And then we've got a seed dealership, a Pioneer seed dealership, and a seed treatment facility that goes along with it for our customers.
And are you showing and telling too?
Yeah, I've worked with our local school to a great degree, bringing kids out. Even rural kids really don't understand what goes on at the farm, and especially in the livestock business. Man, we're in the crosshairs, and so. How can we get ahead of this, and how can we educate people about what we're doing? We talked a lot about that yesterday.
And what are your challenges, and what is your perspective as the CEO from the livestock side of things?
Labor. I mean, labor's huge.
What do you mean?
Where am I going to find kids that are willing to come into a livestock business? I mean, none of them grew up with it anymore. They're four generations, three generations removed from, you know, great grandpa being on the farm. The farm looks nothing like what it used to, with a red barn and a silo next to it. It's a multi-million-dollar business. And like the kid in the video said, he thought about farming. You don't just start farming. The capital investment's huge. So I worry about capital, and I worry about lenders and. And can we put together the money we need to grow the business?
So you have trouble finding people to come work on your farm?
No question.
Okay. You have trouble finding people work on your farm?
Not this year. We have 200 employees. And honestly, we've been pretty aggressive as far as getting them to... I robbed them from other farmers. I just paid more.
I was going to say.
Because of the way that I marketed and we're able to get more money, I can pay, we pay by the piece rate, so we can pay a higher price.
Your neighbors must have appreciated that.
Well, they wave at me with less than one finger. less than four fingers.
You need to show and tell him, I think. Jeremy, what's your labor situation like? And do you find the same thing that Chad finds in terms of labor shortages and people not knowing what the farm is like anymore?
We are. We're having.
I mean, this is a story across the country. Like,
we're having lots of issues with it. We're currently 1 to 60, one hire per 60 applicants right now. I'm guessing it's probably going to be 1 to 100 by the time we start getting our full staff in. That's on general farm labor.
Yeah, I have some very good friends who are dairy farmers, and you know, the old idea that some kid, 14-year-old, gets up at 4 o'clock in the morning to come milk the cow. Forget it. It's, you know, there's they can't find local labor, so it's all,
well, driving tractors. That you don't even drive them anymore, but you know, running those tractors, every kid wants to do, and finding that employee is much easier than finding someone that's going to take care of animals, and somebody that's going to take good care of animals. You're going to pay them, and you're
so
going to
as
keep them.
CEOs, bosses, whatever you want to call yourselves. One of the big concerns, and I know this is an issue in corporate America. You got to worry where your future talent is coming from. Where is your future? So how are you all addressing the future of your farms? Who's going to be your future? Where's the future talent pool? Where's the pipeline?
Well, we have to get immigration reform. I spend time in D.C. I've gone there twice this past. I was there 3 weeks ago. The point of the matter is, no one wants to raise your kid to have the ambition of being an onion plant puller, okay, or being a hog slopper. I mean, you know, so we're going to need.
I think he disagrees.
You say hog stomper?
Slopper.
Oh, slopper.
Slopper.
Oh.
Is that a, I'm sorry. Boy, I shouldn't have said that.
Tried to change that phrase over the years. Come on.
Anyway, so
it takes a PhD to formulate these rations, okay? So
that's right.
We don't slop them.
Anyway, so we're trying to, you know, they're getting older, you know, and we need to have a younger generation come and do these things, and we want to educate our kids not to do these things, but nonetheless, we have to have labor. All of us in agriculture have to have this labor force, and we're somewhat at the bottom end of the hierarchy of jobs. And so we have a little bit of compassion from the politicians because of what positions we're in. They want us, they understand that. But without labor, one way or another, it's going to be harvested and shipped by foreign workers.
Could I ask all of you to talk about, from the perspective of where your farms are going, where your operations are going, where you're going as a business, how you see technology continuing to change what it is you're doing? Because I think that's one of the big dimensions here in this new face of agriculture as you talk about it. So talk about where you talked a lot about data and information before, but what's happening? Where are the changes?
Well, for us, the big thing is just that everything we do is recorded now, we can constantly change everything. We variable rate everything on our operation as we can. You know, we even had the joke of you can variable rate your drink. If it was a bad day, it was this bad. If it was real bad, you had that big of a glass of wine. That's a variable rate drink. Takes them a little while.
You must
to get
be
that
fun
one.
To live with. I
guess. But you know, our seed, our chemicals, our fertilizer, we can variable rate all of our nitrogen, all of our P and K. We're actually, even when we're putting our irrigation out and our watering our rows, we're pushing different size holes on different rows because of the length of the row to make sure it all comes out at the exact same time for there's no waste. So the technology that we use today, we're bringing so much information back, analyzing all that data, and then utilizing that data.
Who's doing
to change.
That? Who's doing that? You have to hire somebody to do that specifically?
Mm-hmm. We spend a lot of time the data coming in and Excel spreadsheets. There's hundreds of them on my desktop right now.
You're nodding your head over there.
Yeah, this is ag today. The technology, frankly, has allowed us to put less trained people in $300,000-$400,000 pieces of equipment because of what it can do. And then it frees us up to do what we really need to be doing, which is probably not sitting in the cab of a tractor.
How's your father look at all this technology and all this data?
Well, I joke with Dad because if everything is set just right, then he can take a tractor to the field, but we tell him don't touch anything.
How's he respond to that?
Yeah, no, he doesn't want to touch it. He's scared to death of it. And I think that's what we need in the next generation of labor that we're going to hire are kids that are tech savvy And we can hire the companies that are going to process the data for us and tell us what is the best seed to plant, what's the best herbicide to put on. But we need kids that are tech savvy and are really interested in a higher end job.
That's a whole marketing campaign, right? To find the right talent. Are you doing that?
I'm not sure how to get the message out. I think we talked some about it yesterday, that still the image of the farm is pretty antiquated, and I'm not sure that urban kids understand the potential that's there with maybe not a college degree even. I don't have a day of college in my life, but I'm not saying that's right for everybody, but there's quite a bit of potential there for these kids.
And talking about the new forms of data and information that you're using, where is that going? What's the newest piece of equipment or software or hardware that you've brought on to manage some of this stuff?
I think on the row crop end of things, it's swath control, it's row control. So in other words, we're not overlapping any herbicides, we're not missing. From that standpoint, I mean, that stuff's been coming out 5-6 years ago. It's
right.
It's in use. The next thing is going to be probably putting different hybrids in different spots of the fields and going that direction. From the hog end of things, it's still labor intense. I mean, you still have to have somebody out there treating sick pigs, making sure everything's got feed, water, ventilation set right. So the livestock's different than the row crop.
The other thing that's changed a lot in agriculture, obviously, is the regulatory environment, right? The environment your dad farmed in is entirely different than today. So speak to that for a minute, as what you as CEOs, bosses, whatever, of these enterprises are now having to deal with in terms of what's being demanded, required of you.
Well, the one thing I always say is that my father-in-law, and I'm a son-in-law, okay, so he was a son-in-law.
You married into the business.
I'm married into it.
You're glad you did that?
Absolutely. the reason is son-in-laws have to prove themselves. I think that maybe you have to work harder. But we have grown up in this regulatory environment, so we're able to accept the additional things they throw at you a little bit easier than what our predecessors have. And, it's just part of the rules. I don't like the fact Department of Labor, because we're big, whenever they come to our county, I mean, they hit us. And they're going to stay there until they find something wrong. I guarantee you they're going to stay. And they appreciate all our hard efforts, but they are going to try their purpose is to figure out a fine.
So what's the pressure point now for you?
Well, when the day after I come out in the Houston Chronicle about immigration reform, Department of Labor shows up. Isn't that ironic?
How'd you do when they showed up?
We actually got through with just a $500 fine because one of the soap dispenser bottles wasn't working, wasn't putting out enough.
Okay. Really?
Your soap dispenser, yeah. So that was the extent of the fine. But, that's just part of the doing business. But the thing that worries me more is in the water situation and the EPA getting in as far as what is a reservoir or a flowing stream. I was intrigued by what he had on that. You just worry, what are they going to throw at you next? And you got to be on the ball. You got to be reading. You got to find what these things are and be proactive.
What are they throwing at you next?
The thing that scares me the most is, like you said, when they show up, they've got this whole list of things that they look for.
Who's they?
It could be Department of Labor, could be OSHA, could be EPA. But when was the last time OSHA came to you and be like, hey, these are the rules, we just changed them 2 weeks ago. Hey, 6 months later, we changed these rules again. 6 months later, we changed these rules. Department of Labor, 6 months, they change rules constantly. How are we supposed to find that out? That's the hard part, is to stay in compliance in an evolving compliant world that is changing around us. We can't have a compliance officer on a farm. If you did, you have to have a huge farm to help.
So how do you stay up with all of this? Do you have somebody whose job it is? I mean, in a typical corporation, if you guys are CEOs, you'd have a general counsel. You got HR. You got your own folks who are monitoring.
I've got my wife.
You got your
she throws stuff at me when I talk about compliance. But it's one of those things. How are we supposed to know these changes?
And we grow cantaloupes. Okay, now we're talking about the food safety. I mean, the listeria and all this is scary. Because am I risking our family legacy by growing this crop? I mean, the Jansons in Colorado, those folks have pled guilty to a misdemeanor. The reason they used a misdemeanor is because you don't have to prove intent with a misdemeanor. So if I have a food safety outbreak, you don't have another chance. You have one shot. That happens, your farm, everything you've done for all these years, they don't have to look at how many millions and maybe billions of pounds of cantaloupes we shipped, and without any issue, you have one issue, you're done.
How about your regulatory environment?
it's pick your poison. We've got the Illinois EPA, and Illinois is not your most business-friendly state. We've got the next thing that we've really got to work through is this pen gestation or crates. And I think it's a battle that's probably lost. When we built our last sow unit in 2012, we put pen gestation in. And that was me thinking through, at some point, are they going to pay me more for these pigs because they came from pens? So I think as CEOs, you constantly have to look out 2, 3, 4 years. What's our consumer want? How are we going to provide it? And what are they willing to pay us for it?
As I've said before, in thinking about everybody in the room and where folks come from and what they're trying to do in terms of thinking about what your stories are, and what's fascinating to me is, and thinking about this is, where is this next generation? Who's training this next generation? What are we saying what's required to be, to go into this increasingly complex business? And we got, three young farmers here. And I'm really interested in your thoughts about, how the future farmer is being trained, recruited, found.
Well, in our situation, I have two great kids. They're living in Austin, and they don't want to work as hard as mom and dad did. And, I say
so they're not interested in the farm?
Oh, they love it. They love it, but they want to run it from Austin. That doesn't happen.
So what do you I'd like to hear that family conversation.
Yeah, I've recruited young men and women to be more like a CEO, to be more of a business, to wear this structure. It's too good of a business just to walk away from.
Right.
And they don't have the money to try to raise the capital that would take to buy it. So we have structured the company where we have LLCs and we have a corporation, and the family keeps the corporation. We're down in the Eagle Ford oil boom. I mean, now we got oil, okay? So, now I can tell a few more buyers to go to hell. we looking at that, what hands you're dealt, looking at the family legacy. My kids are 30 and 26, and who knows? Maybe eventually they may change their mind. But they grew up, growing up, they knew that we didn't have four seasons. We had planting season and harvest season. Yeah, and they knew what it was like to. We're not going to do anything until cantaloupes get done.
I'm going to ask you two guys to weigh in on this, and then we'll open it up to your questions. So if you have questions, please. Prepare yourselves for that, and we'll get them. You guys got the mics? You ready to move with the mics when we start this in just a second? Jeremy.
The big thing I could see was we ran into 3 years ago. We're in the opposite transition. We transitioned 5 years ago from my parents to my sister and I, and then we realized what we needed to do with the operation, and we grew it to where it is today with the help of my parents. But we looked 3 years ago, and we were going through, what ifs. What if so-and-so dies? What if so-and-so dies? And we could see if something were to happen to me, if I was to walk out or and get run over by a car, what was going to happen to the operation? There wasn't someone else in place. And that bothered me from the standpoint of, well, if there is a next generation that wants to take over, but they're not in place yet, what about the 20 families that live out of here right now? What are they going to do for a job? What are they going to do for a career? And that's why we started putting more layers in, more people in, because I want my goal for our operation is to be, if I'm not there that day for whatever reason, life still moves on.
This is a CEO mm-hmm. process. You're thinking succession strategy.
Mm-hmm. And even though I just took over, who's next in line?
Do most people think like this?
Probably. No, I wouldn't say a lot. There's a bunch of them out there that do, but that's not the norm.
I have four daughters, and it used to be, if you didn't have a son to take over the farm, what's going to happen to your farm? Well, the roles have changed. I see no issue someday that one of my daughters or two of them take it over. They can do my job.
Let the record show that the lady in the front here started the applause. Yeah, why don't we have a woman up here?
My wife could be. My
sister was supposed to be here, but she's got to stay home and work.
I see. No, but are there more women coming into farming? Is it hard to do that? Is it harder to do that? And I don't mean coming into farming on the periphery. I mean being the CEO.
I think our jobs are mental. Particularly in a commodity crop, I'm looking at margins 12, 18 months out. And being willing to hedge those positions, as Bruce mentioned, we're price takers. So whatever the market gives us is what we're going to... So it's a mental game. Am I willing to lock in a double instead of a home run? You have to. And so it's a mental game, and then being willing to margin those positions and hold them and not second-guess yourself that, that was pretty stupid, I wish I hadn't have done that. But it's a mental game, and in some ways I think, of course I'm partial because I've got four daughters, but in some ways I think that maybe they're better at it than I would be. And I'm kind of, my product is always more valuable than what it really is in my mind.
I work with my mother, my sister, and my wife, and there's no doubt about it. Depends on what we're working on that day now. They're better at we split up our divide our task of what we're going to do and our responsibilities, and they're 10 times better at their responsibilities than I ever would be. My sister markets a crop. She comes out probably 50% better than I ever would at marketing a crop. So it depends on what we're doing and what the division is. And I don't think it's a male-female thing. It's who's the person and what are they good at and finding that spot for them to work in.
I want to open it up to some questions from the floor. Gentlemen over here. Thanks. Good morning. Mike's right next to you.
With regard to crop farming, I think it's pretty simple. You lower your cost of production and you hedge your bets. But with regard to livestock, I'm concerned in the crates issue. We've always been about producing more and providing affordable food. But I see the people who buy in the animals that you're going to produce changing a market strategy that might not be the least cost of production for you, where the paradigm is shifting completely in the industry. How do you hit that moving target?
You're exactly right. Pen gestation is going to decrease the quality of the care of the animals and increase our costs. And so when Tyson Foods threw us under the bus a month ago with the letter that they sent to all of their producers that we strongly advocate you to move to pen gestation, I emailed them back and said, I assume since you advocate this that you're willing to pay more for this product. Well, no, their consumer is not willing to pay more. So, of course, they're not. So you're right, it's a moving target, but it's the lesser of two evils. I think, it's just the way it's going. We're going to have to adapt.
What's the cost differential there for you?
I would say it's about $3 a pig, a market pig, if I were to try to put a number on it. That's moving also, but did I address your question? Or
how many pigs per litter will it cost you?
I'm sorry, what was the question?
How many pigs per litter?
I would say it could cost us a pig and a half per sow per year. So if we were at 28, it might be 26 to 27 now.
So, front row. Morning. Here we go.
Ron Smith, Southwest Farm Press. Bruce, I know we've talked about this before at the Texas Produce Convention, but I would like to know from you, what you would like to see in immigration reform, and do you think you're going to get it?
Well, first of all, if they don't do anything, they don't pass, it's amnesty. They're going to have, it's amnesty now. Okay. Second thing is, I don't want a government big enough to round up 12 million people. And I think that, you know, the bottom line is when and we ranch right on the Mexican border. I mean, we see it coming across, you know, to see the illegals. We see the travesty, the human trafficking. We live it. We see it. We found, you know, 2 months ago we found two dead bodies on the ranch.
On the property?
On the ranch, on the property. So the reason they're coming is because they don't, illegally. If I was living in Mexico or El Salvador and my family was starving and I needed to provide for them, I might do the same thing. So we need the fact that they are coming here illegally might be, you ever think that maybe it's because they can't come legally? Why don't we have a guest worker program where they come and leave? We don't want to have to tie them to a particular farmer. We all are seasonal. Let them come, and then they can move from one farm to the other. And they have a certain period of time. Now we know that the people that are coming across are illegal, and they're doing it illegally, and they may be doing other things, drugs and trafficking and things of that nature.
Is this the message you took to Washington, I assume?
That's the message.
Yeah, and what'd you hear in return?
I was a lot more encouraged maybe back in May. I don't think a thing's going to get done now.
How much do you both use immigrant labor?
We use a good bit of immigrant labor. We use the H-2A program through and get guys from South Africa. And a lot of people always ask me, you know, how do you feel about immigrant labor? Should we shut borders down? Should we not allow anybody else in the country? And, you know, there's a lot of things that are said. And, you know, I tell people, I was like, you know, be careful what you say, because my parents came from Canada in 1980 and moved to the Mississippi Delta. I'm a son of an immigrant. And if you look around the room, it might be three or four grandfathers or fathers or grandparents in there, but most of the people weren't born. Families didn't come from this land. They came from somewhere else at some time in hope for greener pastures. And I think that's what America's for. So, you know, just it's another food for thought right there to think of. A lot of us, that's how we got here, is for greener pastures.
What's your labor profile?
Yes, at the SOW units, 95% Hispanic.
95%?
Yeah. They're willing to do the work. They're willing to, I mean, you have to understand, when you come into one of our SOW units in the morning, you walk into a room, you strip down naked, you send your lunch under UV light, you lift your feet over onto the showers and you shower and then you're in. And how many 18, 19 year old kids that like Nintendo are willing to go do that?
Are you a voice? Have you been lobbying or speaking out on on this issue?
And
have been.
Another question. Thank you. Yes, sir.
A short but hopefully not simplistic question on the immigrant issue. Would you prefer an immigrant or a robot longer term to do the work you need done?
Well, the mechanization of certain crops, you know, is forthcoming. We'll take spinach cutting. You know, we used to have people hand cut spinach. Now it's all machine cut. In my particular cantaloupes, to be able to tell whether a cantaloupe is ripe and pick this one and not pick that one, it still takes judgment on a human part. The crops that we grow, the onion plants, we grow 900 million of those a year. How many machines would I have to do? And since I control maybe 70-80% of the market, who else is going to help share in the cost of developing these machines? Not anyone. So certain things, yes. Mechanization, if you can mechanize, that's the way to go. Okay, but that there's still, in the fruit and vegetable end of it, there's still going to always have to be hand labor.
Another question from the floor? But in the back of you guys in the back of the room are doing, you know, we gotta get a little something going in the back of the room here. There we go.
Jeff Vanderwerf from the Ag Chat Foundation. Question I have for the gentleman on the end here. As a young farmer, I think that a lot of us look at the CEO model, and as the one producer said in the Farmland movie yesterday, we want to live the same normal lives as all our friends do. We want to be able to take the vacations and go to town and go out to eat and things like that. The thing I struggle with, and I'm curious how you deal with it, is the work-life balance equation of the under 30 demographic is far different than it is in the older demographic. How are you overcoming that on your farm?
I assume it's addressed to me since you said the young man on the end. Is that the rule? Sorry, Bruce.
You're not going to take this lying down, are you?
I really wanted to start answering the question.
No, that's a good question. I mean, addressing work ethic, you're saying of the younger generation. When you grow up as a son of a farmer, you know, it's your way of life. And so your day doesn't necessarily start or end. It's just always going on. And so how do you communicate that to somebody that you're hiring off the farm? You can't. You can't ask an employee to give what you've been willing to give. And I think that's the balance all of us struggle with family time. How do you ever leave the farm when you live on it? Your emails are always there. Your phone's always there. It's a real problem. And I think if I'm kind of sidestepping it a little bit, if my wife was sitting here, she could probably give you a much better answer of to your question.
But when and where was your last vacation?
Well, my wife and daughters went to Disney World last weekend, but I stayed home.
When and where was your last family vacation?
last summer, Florida.
Okay, so you do get away. How about you?
A couple weeks ago, we went on a trip.
Okay. But it's a very interesting question, because you have this notion of this. I mean, it is a different work ethic. And fascinating articles to read about how corporate America is having to adapt to millennials and the sensibilities and sensitivities of millennials. And you're saying you got to do that, but you still got to tend to the work. That can't wait.
You know, the younger people, the fear of failure is a lot greater. You know, with growing things, you're going to fail. And trying to get them to overcome that fear of failure is a big obstacle to try to.
I need to segue on to the next panel, which is going to be fascinating. But before we do this, I want to do something which we love to do in television, which is in the 30 seconds we have left. Yeah. So in the 60 seconds we have left, I want to go down the line, and I want you each to tell me what you most love about your work and what you think the biggest challenge is to the CEO farmer in the years to come.
Most love about my work is that every day I work with people that truly love what they're doing and take pride in their work. And I guess the biggest challenge I have is training the next generation of to take over the company that maybe won't be family.
I think what I enjoy about the work is you're growing crops. What's getting more exciting is that we're able to change the production process of what we've done for years and years to make it more efficient, to produce more by doing less. It's a lot more exciting, and like you said, working with great people that have the same goals as you, it's very rewarding every day. You know, work a 18-hour day at the end of a 7 or a 14-day run. You come home and you're like, you know, I was able to achieve this, and it's very, very rewarding to have this career that we have.
Most challenging?
The most challenging thing that we have is just the black swans, the unknown, the environment, the regulations that are going to become upon us, and I think just the public perception of the public needs to understand is if what's better, to go to the doctor and have a doctor tell you what's right or wrong, or go to the internet and ask Google. Not saying anything's wrong with Google. I do it all the time. But if something's wrong with me, I'm going to go see a doctor. So if I want to know something about food, do I go to a blog or to a Google or to someone who's not necessarily has anything to do with agriculture at all, given their opinion? Opinion and facts are completely different. And that's what, pick the facts.
Chad.
The most exciting thing is we're running million-dollar businesses, and if we want to change direction tomorrow, we can. It's our decision. We don't have to go through a board, a committee, anything like that. You want to make a change? Fine, let's make the change. But therein is also the challenge, is at the end of the day, it's up to me. Did I make a good call or not?
What a great conversation. What I love about this is I think this illustrates how interesting, how varied, how thoughtful, how dynamic, how much personality and of your own skin in the game you've got going here. So I want to thank you all very much and wish you good luck.